Thanks for listening to Only a Game. We'd like to better understand who is listening and how you are using podcasts. Please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. That's all one word. It takes less than 10 minutes and really helps support the show. That's npr.org/podcast survey. And thanks. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. So, as I understand it, the seed for this movie actually was planted when A-Rod contacted you. Is that right?
Yeah. I was approached by A-Rod's publicist in November of 2013. The story of the Biogenesis steroid scandal broke earlier in 2013 when the Miami New Times had this sensational report which blew the lid off of this operation. And among the marquee names was Alex Rodriguez.
That's Billy Corbin. He's a documentary filmmaker who's lived all his life in Miami. And his media studio, Raconteur, is basically known for two things. Movies about drugs, like 2006's Cocaine Cowboys, and movies about sports, like The U and The U Part 2, both produced for ESPN.
Yeah, we tell a lot of stories about Miami, drugs, and sports, which are all very interconnected themes.
Corbin's latest movie is about all three. It's called Screwball, and it's already won the audience awards at the Key West and Miami film festivals.
And I went to Tampa. It was a boutique hotel in Tampa. He knocked on the door, and when the door was open, it was A-Rod. It was Alex. The first words out of his mouth was, "I want whatever Manny was taking."
Screwball features a cast of lip-syncing actors and tells the story of the fall of the Biogenesis anti-aging clinic, where Tony Bosch provided performance-enhancing drugs to dozens of athletes, including the man who was then the highest-paid player in Major League Baseball history, Alex Rodriguez.
Major League Baseball came down hard on Alex Rodriguez. Aside from issuing a lifetime ban, this is the longest suspension in the league's history.
211 regular season games through the 2014 season.
If the arbitrator upholds that 211 game number, the suspension could actually stretch into the 2015 season because
any lengthy suspension for him is potentially career-ending.
I'm fighting for my life. I have to defend myself. If I don't defend myself, no one else will.
So getting back to November of 2013, when Billy Corbin was approached by A-Rod's publicist.
The publicist said Alex is going to be on a break from the arbitration, and he would like to meet with you to talk about the possibility of some kind of tell-all documentary, I think was how it was teased to me. And so I figured, okay, my producing partner, Alfred Spellman, and I will meet with A-Rod, you know, real quiet, you know, hush, hush, top secret. So they said, no, meet us at high noon at Hillstone Restaurant on the most prominent corner of the city, right on Miracle Mile and Ponce de Leon Boulevard, like the power lunch spot in the city. Every seat is taken, three deep at the bar. There's like floor-to-ceiling windows and then an open kitchen. So literally from the street to the dishwashers in the back, everybody can see everything happening in this dining room. And Alfred and I walk in, and we are escorted down the center aisle to the back middle booth, which is literally on a step. It's like on a stage. We had to like step up to join A-Rod, where he was holding court with his publicist and friends, and all eyes were on us. And we sit down with Alex. So we spent about 90 minutes with him where he lied to us about basically everything. It turns out that we were just kind of pawns in his PR offensive against Major League Baseball at that time, because I spent the next 7 months or so corresponding with the publicist about scheduling an interview that never happened. That was the end of A-Rod's involvement in the project, but not the end of the project.
Right. I mean, you decided to do this anyway. So was Anthony Bosch already on your radar? Because he seems like totally the kind of guy in your wheelhouse.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, this guy was a Miami creature if ever there was one.
Who is Anthony Bosch and why is he so crucial to the MLB's investigation?
From Anthony Bosch, the owner and founder of Biogenesis.
He was injected by Tony Bosch in his home on regular occasions.
And Tony, of course, was this fake doctor. He doesn't like when I call him that. He prefers the term unlicensed physician. But the truth is that he did not study medicine in the United States, and he was not licensed to practice it in the United States.
All right. So what happened? Did you, like, call Tony Bosch up and say, I want to put you in a movie? How'd that go down?
It's almost crazier than the A-Rod thing, believe it or not. This was almost exactly a year after we had met with Alex Rodriguez. And now we get a call from Tony Bosch, who says, I'd like to meet with you and discuss the possibility of doing a documentary. And after several meetings in a couple of months, Tony goes to federal prison.
He will be eligible for a reduced sentence if he continues to cooperate. Anthony Bosch, sentenced to 48 months in federal prison.
So once again, we decided to move on and backburner this project. And believe it or not, not even a month after that, I get an email from Tim Elfrink, who is the investigative reporter who broke the scandal. He said, listen, I got a call from Porter Fisher, who was the whistleblower, and he would like to talk to you about the possibility of doing a documentary. And I was like, I'm not a very spiritual guy, but I took pause and I said, if ever the universe was trying to tell us something, I mean, the three central figures in this epic international baseball scandal, all independent of each other, called us. Somebody is trying to tell us to make this documentary. And we decided to right then and there. Tony got out of prison and we interviewed Porter Fisher. We interviewed Tony Bosch and quickly realized from talking to them that, you know, the story is not about A-Rod. Don't tell him that. But it's not about A-Rod, you know. It's really about this Elmore Leonard, Carl Hyacin, Coen Brothers-esque Florida effery, I'll say, for terrestrial radio. that was the story to us, was these crazy characters. And the fact that the career of the highest paid baseball player in history was ended over a $4,000 debt between a cocaine-addicted fake doctor and his fake tan-addicted steroid patient. That, to me, was the story. And so that's the story that we ultimately pursued and told in Screwball.
Give me $4,000, and I'll give you back $4,800. I'll pay you $1,200 every week, and in a month you'll be paid back. I was like, okay.
If you can't understand the deal that Porter and Tony Bosch made for $4,000, it's probably because the deal doesn't make any sense.
You know, we've made a lot of sports documentaries, and with something like The U or The U Part 2, it's a pretty straightforward, borderline paint-by-numbers exercise. Not to belittle the angst of making a documentary, but you interview players, you interview coaches, they talk about games, and you show footage from those games. The thing is, Screwball is not about sports. It's certainly sports adjacent, but they might mention over the hour and 40 minutes of the movie, they mention three different baseball games. There's one game against Kansas City after Tony Bosch starts treating A-Rod when he hits three home runs in that one game.
I asked him how he felt. He says, you know, I feel like if I'm 18 again. I don't know what fuel you put in there, but whatever it is, just keep on putting it.
That's seconds out of the whole thing. So we realized all of this story takes place in nightclubs and locker rooms and hotels and in these shady clinics. And so there's no footage of that. And then listening to the way Tony Bosch told a story and Porter Fisher told a story, who are our two primary narrators, I said, oh, they're so vivid and in the moment. When they tell a story, they do it, for example, I walked into his office and I said, I want my money.
He's like, well, I don't have it. I'm like, Tony, this isn't a game. I want my money back. You're way behind. I want my money. He's like, I'm Dr. Tony Bosch. What are you going to do about it?
Both of them spoke like in dialogue.
So take me to the moment when you had the idea to use actors to help you tell this story. I mean, where were you and what made you think of that?
Drunk. I was drunk, obviously. I was like, oh, wow, we could drunk history this.
Okay, we need to pause here for a second to explain drunk history. It started out on YouTube, but it was so popular that it became a show on Comedy Central. And basically, someone, usually a comedian, gets really drunk and explains some historical event.
I'm Tiffany Haddish, and today we're going to talk about Rose Valland.
And then actors are brought in to lip sync the dialogue that the drunk people are imagining the real life historical characters might have said.
And Rose would be like, I'm gonna memorize this. I'm memorizing all of it.
So Billy Corbin decided to drunk history, the dialogue in his movie, with one pretty big difference.
it dawned on me that, well, everybody acted like children. I mean, and actually worse than children, because I feel like there's just such a level of just disregard for authority and the rules and just selfishness. And they're worse than children. It's not even fair. So I thought, like, wouldn't it be funny if the actors were kids? And like literally 8, 9, 10-year-old kids with facial hair, dressed as cops in lab coats with stethoscopes, pinstripes, Yankee uniforms. There was some inspiration for this and some foundation for it in 1997. This is one of my favorite music videos of all time. I'll never forget the first time I saw it. Spike Jonze, the director, was faced with a unique challenge. He had to produce a posthumous music video for Biggie, who had recently been murdered, for the song Sky's the Limit. And so what he decided to do was just to do a straightforward, classic, archetypal, Bad Boy Records hip-hop music video of the mid to late 90s with the fancy cars, the Versace clothes, the mansion, the pool, the girls, but everybody was 8 years old. The pinstripes and the gray, the one I wore on Mondays and Wednesdays. He had a baby Biggie lip syncing, a baby Puffy, a baby Busta Rhymes, a baby Lil' Kim. Always held that in the back of my mind that would be a really interesting approach someday. And you can't just do it for anything, you know, like Cocaine Cow Babies would not be appropriate. For example.
All right. So after you came up with the idea and before you actually found the kids and started shooting it, you must have sobered up and told someone your plan. How did that conversation go?
Yeah. I was bullish on it. I was psyched, man. You can imagine. Sobered up the next day. And I was like, no, I think it's still a good idea. And they agreed. And I think they knew we were desperate. You know, we needed something. We needed an idea. We needed to do recreations. And recreations are hard, you know, to make them look good, to have them stylistically incorporate into your documentary seamlessly, you know, and so we needed a bold idea. It's pretty out there. And listen, the thing was always called Screwball. That was always our approach to the story. Whenever we make a documentary, like with Cocaine Cowboys, we say, this isn't just a documentary. What genre is this movie? So Cocaine Cowboys, we said, this is a gangster movie. So we made it that way. And same thing here with Screwball. We're like, this is a comedy. So let's make it like a comedy. So every decision we had to make aesthetically would hopefully support the tone. And we went through a lot of trouble to make it happen. So I hope it worked.
Yeah. Well, so how do you go about casting like a 10-year-old A-Rod? Like, what is that process like?
Yeah, well, we kind of did it secretly. We changed the names in the script. We didn't want anybody to know what we were doing. And we wound up with this incredible cast of the most professional, responsible kids who had a very challenging part, which was to not only memorize lines, but to be able to deliver them exactly the way the interview subjects originally said them, and then to be able to lip sync them in perfect time.
One day there's a knock at my door, and I open up the door, and there's two guys standing there. Are you Porter? And I was like, well, who's asking? And they're like, we're with MLB. Detective Riley.
Was there ever a moment that you were watching this and thinking, oh no, this isn't going to work?
I didn't have time for that. It was only later when I was like, what did we do? You know? Because when you're on set, you have a 10-day schedule and all these pages to shoot. And, you know, there's costumes and there's makeup tests and there's art directors who are recreating these locations. If you're not totally confident about it, you certainly have to appear that way as the director, because you're like, you're piloting the ship, man. And everybody's looking at you, you know, going like, is this right? Are we doing this right? Is this good? And I'm like, oh, yeah, totally, totally good, totally right. You know, and I'm like, who the hell knows? I guess, you know, comedy's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, I thought it was working. I had a good feeling.
So take me to when you finally got to show the results to someone else. Was that another nerve-wracking moment?
Yeah, I was excited about it, a little hesitant, and people just started laughing, which was what I hoped would happen. And I didn't care if they were, you know, laughing with us or at us at that point. That's the thing with docs, too. And I notice this when I go to film festivals. Documentaries tend to be really serious. And the audiences tend to come in thinking, all right, this is going to be about drugs and baseball. This is a doping document. This is going to be serious and intense. And so you need to give the audience almost permission to laugh. And it's been a lot of fun touring around the world with it and watching the audience laugh and gasp and giggle and heckle, you know, yell at the screen. It's a lot of fun.
Well, audiences are loving it. What do you think A-Rod would make of it?
Well, I don't knock his hustle. A-Rod is experiencing this, I can't even call it a resurgence in popularity, because let's be real, he was never that popular to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, Yankees fans would boo him you know, at home games, for crying out loud. So his rebirth as a pop culture superstar, I think it's really interesting. I think it's a compelling element to this story.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you don't care what A-Rod thinks of your movie.
No. Putting words in people's mouth is what our documentary is all about, if you think about it. But no, you listen, I can't imagine he wouldn't get a kick out of it. It's all true, and I don't think he would argue with the facts of it. It's one of the most meticulously, if not the most meticulously researched documentary we have ever done. And I think, listen, tonally, I think it's a lot of fun, and I think he might be at a place in his life. At least I hope he is, where he's happy and he's healthy and he's successful and he can laugh at himself. I have no trouble laughing at him. I hope that he would have no trouble laughing at him either.
That's documentary filmmaker Billy Corbin. His latest movie, Screwball, was released in theaters this week. During the filming of the hockey scenes in 1970s Love Story, co-star Ryan O'Neal ran afoul of then-Harvard hockey coach Bill Cleary.
Well, I really unloaded on him. I said, who the hell do you think you are? I could care less about you or Hollywood or anyone else.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. The NCAA tournament continues this weekend. We're going to start this week's segment by talking about some stats you probably won't hear about during the television broadcasts. I'm joined by New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach and by Derek Jackson, contributor to The Undefeated. Welcome to both of you.
An honor, as always.
Thank you, Karen.
Derek, you're up first.
This is my 23rd year of doing graduation rates of both the football bowl teams and the March Madness basketball teams. And the part I really enjoy is comparing the women's graduation rates with the men's, particularly since, in a very real sense, what the women are doing represents one of the highest forms of equality in all of American education. So this year, the entire women's field had a graduation rate, as defined by the NCAA, of 92%.
Wow.
96% for white players, 88% for black players. So there's a little room for growth, because 88 is a B+. 31 of the women's teams had a 100% graduation rate for black women. This contrasts very different with the men. To be clear, the men's graduation rates, including the black athletes, has improved over the years. What has still remains, to me, a very symbolic of the exploitation that still goes on is the disparities between the white graduation rates and the black graduation rates. The worst was Abilene Christian, with a gap of 46 percentage points between the 29% for black players and the 75% for white players. There were several other schools where the graduation rates were at least 33 percentage points different. And in fact, in lots of metrics, it just seemed like, in so many cases, the success of black men compared to white men was sort of three-fifths that success. So I called it the three-fifths compromise, hearkening back to the constitutional compromise in 1787. So the women play the same number of games as men. Mm-hmm. The intensity to perform is the same as the men. And Somehow those programs still graduate their players. The men don't. There's no excuse.
And before I send it to you, Will, we should just point out that these stats do not include players who go pro early but are in good standing academically with the university, right? Like, those people are just not included in these stats.
That's correct. And they get credit for transfers who come in and do graduate.
Great.
So it's the most generous statistic the NCAA could offer.
The idea of graduation rates in college sports, frankly, so rarely even comes up in conversation anymore. To be honest, the debate about college sports has actually kind of gone away from are we graduating these players and more why aren't we paying these players and how do we... And I'm really glad, Derek, that you are actually... Like, this is something you've stayed on for so long, because not to say that the conversation we're having about paying players is not important, but the idea that, like, these... I know that we have tried to... During the tournament, we kind of pretend it's not about college basketball, it's actually about college,
right.
But it is. These people are actual college students, and the point of going to college is to graduate. And for some reason, this used to be a central part of every conversation about college sports, and I think it's almost faded away entirely.
You know, it's so funny. Every time I have a conversation with someone about the concept of paying players, they say, why would you pay them? They're getting a free education. And I'm like, no, many of them are not getting a free education. And that's really kind of the point here. You know, I've been following these reports for many years, maybe not all 23, but a lot of the years I've been paying attention to them. And it feels like the takeaway is usually somewhere along the lines of progress has been made, but gaps still remain. And you bring up Abilene Christian, which is just, someone has really got to talk to them. But overall, it seems like this progress is very, very slow. And I'm wondering if you ever find yourself adding up all these numbers and just wanting to scream at your computer screen and say, why aren't we getting better faster?
Well, I know why we're not getting better faster. I once asked Mark Emmert, the head of the NCAA, shouldn't you track these graduation rates and think about sanctions in terms of race? Because so many of these schools, they technically get to the 50% graduation rate that is kind of the rough standard now that's acceptable, mm-hmm. To avoid sanctions by having these astronomical white rates and horrible or mediocre black rates. And to me, black athletes are the canary in the coal mine in division men's basketball and football, because they're vastly disproportionately represented on these teams. And he said no. And I actually called the office about a couple years ago to try to update this, because these disparities continue. And I didn't get a response. So unless the NCAA is going to deal with the racial aspect of these graduation rates, there's not going to be any change.
On Monday morning, at March Madness, tweeted a meme with the caption, quote, when you find out there are no hashtag March Madness games until Thursday. The only problem? Well, round two of the women's tournament was being held that very same night. Now, if we try to point out all the stupid things that has ever been said on Twitter, we will be here all day and all day tomorrow and all day the day after that. But it does bring up something really interesting to me, and that is that the NCAA actually has two separate Twitter accounts for the men's and the women's tournaments. So the men get at March Madness, which is, quote, the official NCAA March Madness destination for all things Division I NCAA men's basketball, hashtag March Madness, end quote. It has nearly 1.4 million followers. Now, the other Twitter account is at NCAA WBB. Yeah, just try to say that. And it doesn't even use the March Madness hashtag, but instead relegates women's games to hashtag NCAAW. I mean, I can't even say it. It's ridiculous. Why, oh, why do we need two separate Twitter accounts for the men's and women's tournaments? Are men's fans really going to turn away from their Twitter machines if they're forced to watch women celebrating games? They're not. So I feel that there should be no reason why we shouldn't let fans of the men's game know how much fun the women are having. Derek, what do you think?
Totally agree. I mean, I wish the NCAA would take just a little bit of a look at tennis, going back to Navratilova, Everett, Billie Jean King, and now obviously the Williams sisters. You know, the interest in that I wish they'd take a look at what are the top sports looked at in the Olympics, figure skating, gymnastics. I mean, my wife and I sit up for hours watching women's gymnastics during the Olympics. We probably watch that together more than any other sport. And so I think the NCAA has a little, they believe too much in the old stereotype that the athletic feats of men, stronger, powerful, all that. And frankly, I enjoy watching the women play. I can follow the strategy. I also know they're in it for, you know, much more substantive reasons than a lot of the one and dones.
Well, you know, I think one way to tackle this would be to look at the sponsors of the tournament. The corporate champions of the tournament, as they are called by CBS. Sorry, I didn't mean to call them sponsors. They're much more hallowed than mere advertisers. But I mean, the NCAA has often separate deals with the women's tournament and the men's tournament, which I think that for me, you get Coca-Cola or you get Capital One or other champions to maybe actually be a larger part of the women's tournament. I think that would make a difference. But the NCAA, listen, one of the craziest things about the tournament is there is 11 months out of the year, we think that NCAA are like the most, we hate them and we boo them. And then 1 month of the year, we're like, hey, did you fill out your bracket? We like it. But it is kind of funny though, because I think the NCAA is even losing this month a little bit more. But one of the few things I like about the internet anymore is when a brand will try to do like a funny meme, but like says something stupid and or offensive and just gets hammered for it afterwards, because the brands are not your friends. So just because the brand does like a funny Parks and Recreation gif does not mean that they're cool. It just means that they have a probably very underpaid social media intern.
Absolutely. But speaking of that very underpaid social media intern, one of the things that's always said about promoting women's sports is, oh, it's going to cost money, right? Hey, if you just merge the social media streams, you have one less underpaid social media intern to pay. Will, you're up.
So opening day was this week. And there's an Effectively Wild podcast, a great podcast by Sam Miller and Ben Lindbergh and Meg Rowley. And they have a theory that baseball would be a lot better if you just had no off-season news, and then just the season started, and you were like, wow, Bryce Harper's on the Phillies now. Paul Goldschmidt's on the Cardinals. That's amazing. And that sounds like comical. But I have to say, I thought about this a lot on opening day this week, because you know, we spent this entire offseason hearing about nothing's happening. But the idea that like nothing happened, there were massive shifts that went on in baseball this offseason. This got me thinking, if I may pick this all the way around, of the end of the Mueller investigation. I wrote about this for New York Magazine. We've had so much speculation and so much what's in there, what's going to happen, that people are exhausted. So by the time it actually has come out, we're all just like, yeah, boy, we expected so much worse. It's a general kind of the way we cover both sports news and political news has become to the point that we are physically incapable of having perspective on it. So I always think about my father. My father does not pay attention to offseason news. He doesn't pay attention to sports recruiting. He just goes in on opening day. He's like, hey, awesome. Look who's on our team now. And on one hand, that sounds insane in this media environment to do that. On the other hand, he was like, wow, this is really exciting that Paul Goldschmidt's on the Cardinals now. And wow, Trump really did a lot of stuff. You tell me, who's right, me or him? I think it's him.
Derek, what do you think?
Well, I'm with you all the way, man, because I remember summer 2008, I was on a scout trip in New Mexico. And when we took off, we were looking at ESPN on takeoff to New Mexico. It was the story, was Brett Favre retiring? Was he going to another team? And then we were in the New Mexico wilderness for 2 weeks. And when we were at the airport going home to Boston, it's 2 weeks later. And Brett Favre is still not decided whether he's retiring or going to another team. So I said, that's it. I'm not going to pay any attention to this stuff in the summer anymore during the football offseason. I'm with you.
You know, well, we're laughing about this. But I think there are consequences to the fact that we pay this much attention to this very small incremental news. I think it's really kind of somewhat dangerous. Like, we think back to just 5 weeks ago, Manny Machado had just signed what was, at the time, the largest free agent deal in history. And we were kind of unmoved. You know, we were like, no, nothing has happened. Nobody signed. This is ridiculous. Players Union head Tony Clark was using words like strike and hinting at collusion. And of course, since then, the record set by Machado has been broken. And I'm beginning to wonder if the reason why we went straight to strike instead of just there are problems with free agency is because there was all this incremental news of nothingness. And it just kind of has me worried. Am I being cynical or is there something really there?
No, I mean, this has happened. This is not just in baseball, too.
Right.
Like, look at like the NBA. The NBA has had this, actually, whether you consider it a problem or not, they've certainly had the situation for a few years now where talking about the NBA seems to often be more exciting for people than actually physically watching the NBA. And it's funny, to me, the example of this now in the NBA is Kevin Durant with the Knicks. Mm-hmm. Like, honestly, the idea of Kevin Durant, one of the best players in NBA history, going to the Knicks, who I literally just saw them play last week, and they lost to a team of second graders that played at halftime. Like, it is unbelievable that Kevin Durant might go to the Knicks. But because there's been all these stories and all these rumors and all these so on, by the time that happens, if it happens, and I can't believe it could possibly happen, but if it happened, we'll be like, yeah, we kind of saw that. Like, real life is just somehow not satisfying as our imaginations running away with us.
Well, so how do we fix it? What do we do about it?
I think it's time to shut down the internet, Karen. I think I don't know. I think it's going to be too late. It's too late to put that genie back in the bottle, I'm afraid.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach and Derek Jackson, contributor to The Undefeated. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Karen.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Did you just make that up?
Well, yeah. I just...
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, how a crisis of confidence led Des Linden to her best performance and a Boston Marathon title. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
Purdue topped Tennessee on Thursday night, which broke the bracket of Greg Nigel, the man who, as far as we know, was the first to pick a perfect Sweet 16. Would you like to offer a tip of the OAG cap to Nigel anyway?
Well, I think, you know, he picked the original bracket while he was on cold medicine. And I think there's no question that, you know, you get him off drugs and he's not very good at this. No, it's a remarkable thing. It may be 90% luck. I don't care. He has a distinction, and the University of Tennessee should be enormously disappointed that they let him down.
I'm using the as far as we know disclaimer because we're only really talking about brackets submitted through NCAA.com, ESPN, Yahoo, CBS, Fox, and Sports Illustrated. And the NCAA has only been tracking brackets since 2016. So I suppose it could have happened before the internet.
See, you know what's going to happen now? We're going to hear from some survivalist in Maine who gets his news over the crystal set, who picked the 2001 bracket perfectly.
It is not easy to replace Pat Summitt, one of the most beloved and successful women's college coaches of all time, Charlie. And this week, Holly Warlick discovered exactly how difficult it is. The Tennessee women's basketball coach was relieved of her duties after the team failed to make it past the opening weekend of the tournament three seasons in a row. Did you ever think you'd see mighty Tennessee fall this far?
It was interesting because back in the day, when the women's tournament came around, Bill and I used to joke that the only two teams that anybody ever heard of was Tennessee and Connecticut. And I just realized maybe a month ago that I hadn't heard anything from Tennessee in a long time. Right. There's Mississippi State, there's Notre Dame, South Carolina, all big high-profile programs. And I had not realized that they had gone out in the first round of the tournament 3 years in a row. At dynasty schools, in any sport, in any gender, that doesn't happen. You lose your job.
This might be terrible for Tennessee, but it might not be so terrible for women's basketball.
No, I think that the way the talent is spread out now, you've got teams with enormously good records, places like Baylor, who we wouldn't think of 10 years ago. So, no, I think that if the game can catch up with Connecticut, the game can catch up with anybody.
After losing in the World Series 2 years in a row, the LA Dodgers clearly wanted to make their winning intentions known. So what did they do? Get a new slogan?
They hit 8 home runs, which is really cool, actually. They won 12-5 over the Diamondbacks. That's kind of a statement game, I guess, as any statement can be in the first of 162.
Meanwhile, the defending champion Red Sox lost their first game of 2019, but that's okay because they lost their first game last year, and that turned out all right.
Yes, the panic is rising outside our studio windows even as we speak, though.
The NFL has done something many said it would never do, and that's allow replay on non-calls. Both offensive and defensive pass interference will be reviewable for at least the 2019 season. I guess that's what happens when you're trying to hold the biggest event of the year, the Super Bowl, and nobody can stop talking about that missed call from 2 weeks earlier.
Yeah, that's the non-call that may or may not have cost the Saints the NFC Championship against the Rams. I think that everybody who's cheering this is going to hate it by the middle of November because you're not going to have referees talking about something that didn't happen or at least officially didn't happen. And that requires referees to think, and that's never a good thing.
I don't know. I'm the weird person who kind of enjoys the debate that goes on in the broadcast booth while the guys are under the hood. I kind of find it fascinating, but I'm probably the only one.
Yes, you are. I've polled the entire population of the United States, Karen, and you're the only person who finds that fascinating.
The NFL did not approve a proposal that would have addressed the other major controversy of last season's conference championship games. The Kansas City Chiefs proposed that overtime rules should be amended so that each team is guaranteed a possession. Does this happen every year? Lose a game, suggest a rules change?
Yeah, pretty much. And this one has been suggested a number of different times, mostly by teams that lost the coin flip and subsequently the game. Play defense. Then you don't have to worry about winning or losing a coin flip.
According to Tom Dundon, the new majority owner of the Alliance for American Football, the league is in danger of folding because the NFL Players Association won't allow them to sign players already under contract with the NFL. Gee, isn't that the kind of thing the league should have worked out before they launched?
I was about to say, if the league has only been around for however, 6 months or something, and you're already on your second majority owner, you've got real problems. Why would they think some 22-year-old would want to play football all year?
Right.
I mean, with no time to rest up at all. You'd get some people who are talented enough so that eventually your football league is the only thing they play in because they're not good enough to play in the NFL. But no good player is going to want to do that.
And finally, Charlie, over the weekend, Moise Kean became the second youngest player to score for Italy in an international match at the age of 19 years and 23 days. And that led Kean's father to bring up the fact that he still hasn't been paid for encouraging his son to sign for the Juventus Youth Academy. And the payment he's been waiting for is...
2 tractors! They promised him 2 tractors, and they haven't delivered yet.
I want my
Everybody
2 tractors.
In international soccer is crooked. What can I tell you? They promise you anything to get your kid to go to their camps. You know, they promise you a couple of tractors. They won't even deliver one.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen. You don't even get a snowblower.
Odds are your March Madness bracket is busted. Much, much worse than that guy who had a perfect Sweet 16. But don't worry, you can still build the perfect podcast feed. Subscribe to the Only a Game podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to the show. And while you're there, leave a review. And thanks. On Valentine's Day 1970, a new novel by Eric Segal hit bookshelves. It was called Love Story, and it was based on the screenplay for a movie that hadn't even been released yet. The 125-page book sold more copies than any novel that year. Joe Britannia, then a college hockey goaltender, remembers it.
It was the type of book you could start reading when you got on an airplane and finish it before the plane took off.
The movie was released later that year.
From the most widely acclaimed new novel of the 1970s, Ally McGraw and Ryan O'Neill star in the number one bestseller by Eric Segal, Love Story.
Like the book, the movie was panned by critics as shallow and pointless. Spoiler alert, it's the tale of college students Oliver Barrett IV and Jennifer Cavalieri. He plays for the Harvard hockey team. She studies music at Radcliffe. They fall in love, get married, and then she dies. But the filming of the movie presented a challenge, and that challenge had to do with hockey. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
One day in early 1969, Harvard hockey coach Bill Cleary was in his office. He got a phone call from film producers Howard Minsky and David Golden.
And they said, look, we got this movie we want to make. Eric Siegel gave me a name and number, and we'd like to come up and talk to you.
Eric Siegel and Bill Cleary's brother Bob graduated Harvard in 1958. Bill and Bob had played on the Harvard hockey team and led the 1960 U.S. Olympic hockey team to a gold medal.
They needed people that could skate, so I said, hey, we got the Harvard hockey team.
The producers said Bill and Bob Cleary would also get to appear in the film. Bob is a referee, and Bill is the body double for leading man Ryan O'Neill. And they would advise the skaters in the hockey scenes. Bill imagined a big Hollywood payday.
So I said to them, give me half of 1% of the revenues.
Minsky and Golden said no. Bill Cleary settled for a contribution to Friends of Harvard Hockey and new blazers for the team. In December of 1969, filming began at Harvard's home arena. The skaters included players from Harvard, and there was one Boston University player who could speak French. He was cast as a French-Canadian opponent who gets in a fight with Oliver Barrett. Joe Bertagna was an 18-year-old freshman goalie for Harvard. He skated onto the set wide-eyed and ready to go.
You're excited to be part of it, but then when you were actually showing up, it was a very tedious project.
You shoot a scene, but then you'd wait.
They might adjust the camera angle or the lighting, and you were there all day.
Some of the shots, we went through 15, 20 times.
The movie's first hockey scene shows a Harvard rush. The action is shot from just above the ice surface.
Avid goal, Ackerman, assist, Barrett.
The camera was at ice level.
I actually ran that, it was like a sled almost.
The sled was simply a camera mounted on a piece of plywood. Cleary's job during that scene was to push it the length of the ice as it trailed the skaters. He had to do that a lot because one player, he's not sure now who it was, had a hard time following the script.
And he was going in on the goaltender and he was supposed to score, but he missed so many times. I'm saying, put the puck in the net.
Well, you told him that during the week too. So
Cleary had a much tougher time with the film's co-star, Ryan O'Neill.
Oh, he couldn't skate. He couldn't handle a puck or anything.
They'd shoot him from the waist up, and he'd be moving his eyes and his head like he was scanning the ice, because if you saw him from the waist down, his knees were together, he was over on his ankles. He's a Southern California guy who didn't know how to skate.
There was another problem. Ryan O'Neill had a full head of wavy blonde hair. The 35-year-old Cleary was follically challenged. But someone in the wardrobe department came up with a solution. Customize Cleary's crimson hockey helmet.
So they sewed the wig in it so I could look like Ryan.
The wig was bushy and blonde.
When they called for his scenes, I remember they'd put the helmet on and some guy would come out with a brush or comb and they'd comb the wig.
Oh, yeah.
And we got a kick. You know, we were still relatively new to Billy as his players. I mean, to see our coach getting his hair combed or his fake hair combed, we got a pretty good kick out of that.
They may have had the same hairstyle, but Ryan O'Neill didn't share Bill Cleary's views about one of hockey's unwritten rules.
Someone comes up to me and said, Ryan is walking on the cement with skates. I gave him a little heat about it. I said, you don't do things like that.
But Cleary says O'Neill walked on the concrete the next day, too.
Well, I really unloaded on him. I said, who the hell do you think you are? I could care less about you or Hollywood or anyone else.
Cleary says O'Neill avoided him after that. Cleary wondered whether he had stepped on director Arthur Hiller's toes when he chewed out Love Story's leading man.
And I went up and apologized to Arthur Hiller. He says, oh no, I'm glad you did it. He's getting unbearable.
Scenes were shot at Harvard's arena for two different games. A home game against Dartmouth, and an away game, sort of, against Cornell.
They probably had 200 extras. And depending on where the scene was being shot, those 200 people moved from section to section.
Cornell goal, Pesce. Score tied, 3-3.
And the same people, they would either wear a white and green scarf if they were Dartmouth fans and a white and red scarf if they were Cornell fans.
The shoot wrapped up after 3 days.
And they were long days, let me tell you. It was a wonderful experience, and I have a little bit more appreciation what it takes to make a movie.
On December 16th, 1970, Love Story opened at cinemas across the country. Bill Cleary and Joe Britannia attended the premiere at a Boston-area theater, along with about 1,500 of their closest friends.
I thought the hockey scenes were pretty good.
But once the thrill of seeing himself on the silver screen, albeit briefly, had worn off for Britannia, reality set in.
I thought it was a little sappy. It was kind of simply tugging at heartstrings and a story that wasn't completely believable.
There were some editing issues, too. Like when Oliver has an in-game conversation with Jenny.
Why are you sitting here when all your friends are out there playing?
I'm in the penalty box.
What?
I'm in the penalty box.
What did you do wrong?
Barrett sits in the box wearing number 7, the same number worn by body double Bill Cleary.
And then the camera shows number 7 skating by, so they missed that one.
But since when did continuity problems or general sappiness derail a half-good tearjerker romance? Love Story was a box office smash. It's taken in over $100 million since its release. Cleary chuckles when he acknowledges that his proposed cut of half of 1% would have been a half million. But it did give him and Britannia an experience they'll never forget.
How many times does an individual get to make a movie or be a part of it?
We haven't made any sense, Billy.
No, we haven't. And I don't think it's going to happen again,
No, I don't
Joe.
Think so. Well, I tell people I didn't want to get typecast as a goaltender, so I've been rejecting scripts ever since.
Even so, Britannia hasn't managed to shake his 15 minutes of fame. Once, in the early 90s, he recognized a familiar face at a state dinner in Washington, D.C.
We knew her as Pinky. It was her nickname when she was at school.
From 1969 to 1973, Pinky Buto was an undergrad at Radcliffe College, the school Jenny attended in the movie. Pinky loved hockey and knew all the Harvard players. She would later be more widely known as Benazir, and also as the Prime Minister of Pakistan. Britannia spotted her from across the room.
So I started walking towards the table, and she's sitting with Vice President Quayle and his wife. And I could see she recognizes me. And she gets up and she extends her hand. Oh, Joey, so good to see you. Let me introduce you to the vice president. So Vice President Quayle stands up and she says, Mr. Vice President, this is Joe Britannia. He was the goalie in Love Story. And I'm thinking to myself, that's it? I mean, that's my life has been reduced to that. And I shook the vice president's hand and went back to my table at that point.
Bill Cleary, the one with the hearty laugh, is enshrined in the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame. 3 years ago, he and his wife went to see Love Letters, a play starring Ally McGraw and Ryan O'Neill.
And it was great. Ryan and Ally were terrific.
After the show, Cleary went backstage.
So I went up to the fellow at the stage door, and I explained to him how I did the skating for Ryan. I said, I don't know if he wants to say hello.
Cleary says he hadn't spoken with O'Neill since he scolded him way back in December of 1969. But Ryan O'Neill emerged, smiling.
He said, do I remember the time you chewed my out? Now, that's how many years ago. And he can still remember it.
Well, you got your point across.
I think I made the point. He was so, so nice. I was pleasantly surprised.
Maybe Bill Cleary shouldn't have been surprised, because after all...
Love means never having to say you're sorry.
I just had to end the story with that. I'm sorry.
Love means never having to say you're sorry.
Right. I'll try to remember that.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.